a zinc and a nickel atom at the copper site in a high-TC superconductor. So this work is a collaboration between my group in Berkeley and Uchida's group in Tokyo. And a very important person in that group is Hiroshi Isaki, who at present is at Stanford. And I'll comment on the people in my group later in the talk. So let me just remind you how STM works. Generic STM, you have a sharp tip, atomically sharp. You have a device which can scan it over the surface. It's in tunneling range. We usually make this junction resistance here 1 gigohm. So for millivolts, we have, picoamp currents tunneling through here. And in the simplest mode, you just keep the current constant while scanning the tip with this mechanical system. And you keep it constant by virtue of the fact that the current is exponential in the distance, and you can feed back on changes in the current as the tip scans the surface. And then the tip just follows a trajectory of constant density of states along the surface, and you can generate an image. Could I turn off some more lights? Now, there's another mode in which you can use an STM. Thank you. It's a spectroscopic mode, and this is the one which is more important for study of correlated electron materials and many other situations. Here's the tip in the sample. You bias the sample relative to ground, and then you measure the current passing through the tip here. So here's a schematic representation of the density of states in the sample as a function of energy. This is the energy axis, and here's the Fermi level, and these states are filled. And here's a schematic representation of the density of states in the metallic tip. It's flat as a function of energy. And at very low temperatures, it drops down to zero at the Fermi level of the tip. Now, these two Fermi levels are different by an amount which is EV, where V is the sample bias. As you raise this voltage, you're raising the potential of these guys and lowering the Fermi level over here. And you're revealing more and more and more empty states in the sample. So the current which travels into the sample, the change in the current dI for a given change in dV is just the density of states at that energy above the Fermi energy. So the standard observable is that dI dV, the derivative, the differential tunneling conductance, as a function of V, should have the same function as the density of states of energy at energy EV. And that's the main tool we use, as well as the atomic resolution. Now, there are many, many types of STMs in the world for many, many different applications. People often ask me at the end of this talk, well, how come your STM could take this picture and somebody else's STM couldn't take that picture? That's like asking how one car can have one performance and a different car has a different performance. The machines are very complicated, and they're designed for many different purposes. This one is designed to deal with issues of high-TC superconductors. And it's very different, for example, than the famous STM of Don Eigler. It's a very low temperature STM. It goes down to about 0.25 Kelvin. Externally, it has a very massive vibration isolation system of the type used for millikelvin physics, the type we used, for example, to do the experiments I discussed yesterday. It's just tons of concrete and lead and passive damping and rubber and a whole bunch of stuff to reduce the vibration level here. Then it has a very special refrigerator and then a vacuum space at low temperatures. This has cryogenic ultra-high vacuum. And then a helium-3 refrigerator, which can cool this stage to a quarter of a Kelvin. And then right here below the helium-3 refrigerator and in the center of this 7.5 Tesla magnet is this object. It's a very compact, stiff STM whose purpose it is to achieve atomic resolution, repeatable atomic resolution, on a surface which is prepared by cleaving here in the cryogenic ultra-high vacuum at low temperatures. This vacuum is much better than so-called ultra-high vacuum, maybe 7 to 10 orders of magnitude better. Nobody really knows. So what we do is, when this machine is cold, we introduce a sample through this manipulation system from room temperature. We cleave the crystal here and then immediately insert the sample into this receptacle here in the STM head. And this approach mechanism then brings the tip, which is right there. It brings it up from below and it finds the surface and it starts scanning. Now let me remind you some issues of impurity atoms. Let's say in a metal, it's been known for a very long time that for potential scattering of an impurity atom in a metal, one simple response of the electron gases to generate Friedel oscillations. Here's a picture on the surface of, I think, either copper or gold, made by Mike Crommie and Don Iger. There's two impurity atoms here, and you can see the Friedel oscillations. And basically, to understand it, you solve for the perturbation in the density of states due to the extra potential scattering of the free electrons at those positions. Now, there's another phenomenon that can occur, though, if you have a stronger scattering, let's say in a metal, and it's called a virtual bound state. So if you had potential scattering at an impurity atom, and there's the Hamiltonian in the absence of the impurity, and this represents some energy nearby the impurity, then in principle you can calculate the local effects of this perturbation. If you know what the T matrix is, the perturbation in the density of states is related to the trace of the free particles, Green function, the T matrix multiplied by the Green function, trace of that. And so this is a well-known phenomenon. You can, in principle, find what the T matrix is by using this famous equation. I think it's called the Lippmann-Schwinger equation in high-energy physics. If B is very strong, of course, you bind an electron. That's like putting an electron of a different species in a conductor. You can bind another electron at that site. But there's an intermediate case where the solution doesn't produce a real bound state. It produces a virtual bound state, which is a tendency to localize the electrons for a short period of time at that impurity atom site. And it's the equivalent of this physics that we're working on now in the high TC context. Now, let me just remind you the BCS picture of superconductivity. It's at the value of energy which produces a pull in the T matrix. The virtual bound state is in the conduction band. It's not a real state like below the conduction band. It's in the conduction band. And there's continuous tunneling from the virtual bound state from the conduction electrons back and forth. If the energy of the virtual bound state were to exit from the conduction band, then it'll become a real bound state. Okay, so in the BCS picture of superconductivity, you have a ground state wave function, which is the creation of Cooper pairs from the vacuum. Yes, it is. It's a resonance by virtue of the fact that the line width is much wider than 1 kT or the natural line width for binding something at that energy. So it's in continuous tunneling with the conduction electrons. Okay. So the point I wanted to make here is that the elementary excitations of this system are Bogoliubov quasiparticles. Here's the creation operator. You create a spin-up electron with a certain probability and then a spin-down hole with a different probability. These are the Bogoliubov coherence factors. And in the S-wave case, they're just a certain, when they're squared, they're a certain number. But here, they're a certain complex number. In the D-wave case, they're more complicated because, of course, the energy that goes in here is a function of the K, and the energy gap is not uniform in K in the D-wave space. So these things actually are very complicated numbers sometimes in the D-wave superconductor. But nonetheless, these quasiparticles in an S-wave case should open a gap at the Fermi level, and then the density of states looks something like this around the gap, and here's the dispersion relationship. In terms of tunneling, that results in the S-wave case in this situation. A normal tip and a superconducting sample, there's two possibilities. When you bias the sample, you could raise the Fermi level of the tip and tunnel real electrons into these empty quasiparticle states above the energy gap. Here's the ground state. And the other possibility is that when you lower the sample Fermi level, you can break a pair, capture an electron, and excite a quasiparticle. These two processes are symmetric so that the observable DIDV as a function of V looks like this. And that's been well known for many decades, that's what it looks like in the S-wave case. Now you can ask yourself, what would happen if you had an impurity atom in the S-wave case? And according to Anderson's view of the situation in the theory of dirty superconductors, nothing should happen. If this is a potential scatterer, so it doesn't break time reversal symmetry, then whatever happens, it'll make a pair of states, and you can rediagonalize all the basis set, and then you can generate a new BCS ground state. No localized state is supposed to exist at a potential scattering impurity atom in an S-wave superconductor. And here I just showed schematically what we believe would happen at that site. Now, this is not true in D-wave, and that's the essence of what I'm going to discuss today. I just want to remind you of another phenomenon in S-wave. In S-wave, if you had a static magnetic impurity embedded in the superconductor, so you have an on-site impurity potential, so that's the spin of the static impurity atom, that's the potential. This W here is the energy scale for splitting due to interactions of the conduction electrons and that static moment. Then you can write down the T matrix, and you can find the poles in the T matrix, and you can identify the fact that there should be two bound states. And Shiba, this paper is very clear on the solution, showed that there are two particle hole symmetric bound states of a magnetic impurity in an S-wave superconductor. They're intergap states. And in fact, there is, so schematically they look like this. Experimentalists like to convey this idea in cartoons. So you have some magnetic moment embedded in the sample, and it's preferential, energetically preferential that a spin-down electron can tunnel to this site. That's a lower energy situation. So you find a peak in the density of states inside the gap, which is spin-polarized. And if you reverse the bias, there's a reverse situation of Cooper-Pair-Vaking, so a spin-up electron can tunnel out from this site, and you find a spin-up peak at this site inside the gap. So this is what had been believed to be the case for many years for a single magnetic impurity atom in S-wave. And in fact, Ali Asdani and Don Eigler and Mike Crommie and their collaborators were able to show a couple of years ago that there's some good evidence that this is precisely what happens. They put magnetic atoms, for example, gadolinium is a very strong one, on the surface of a conventional superconductor, and by STM they measured the perturbation in the density of states. And this is the change from the background, and they view this as being evidence of the two Shiba states, spin-polarized state at positive bias for the electrons, and a spin-polarized state of the other spin polarization at negative bias. So that's the situation with S-wave. So we're interested in the high TC superconductor, and BISCO is a very good material for us to work with because it's cleavable. Here's the unit cell. If you break this crystal, it breaks on this long bond between the bismuth oxide planes. So it reveals a bismuth oxide surface. This is the top surface. And in STM, we see the bismuth atoms. Now, something I'd like you to remember is that underneath each bismuth atom, two layers down, a bit more than 5 angstroms away, is one of the copper atoms in the copper-oxygen plane. You see underneath each bismuth atom is a copper atom. And those are the sites that we're going to be interested in. Now, this cleaved material, if you image it using STM, so this is a large field of view image, you see a lot of phenomena in here, and most of them are irrelevant, in fact, for the properties of high TC. BISCO has a static modulation that runs through the crystal. The crystal is periodically distorted from its symmetry, and that's what you see, you know, apparently wave-like phenomenon running along this axis, which is the B-axis. That's a static modulation in the surface of the crystal running in this direction, and it exists in all layers of BISCO. And then this mottled characteristic you see here is of unknown source, but it's not instrumental, and these guys are a few impurity atoms, which we could either study or take out of the field of view. So if we zoom in on this guy a little bit to get down to atomic resolution, this is a fairly typical picture. So this axis here is a theorist's x-axis, and this is the y-axis. So the square lattice of theory is oriented this way. And this axis here is the b-axis, and this is the a-axis. They're the ones the experimentalists focus on. Sorry. And you see a lot of phenomena in here. You see this mottling. The source of this mottling is still unknown. You see the square lattice is highly distorted. And then indeed you see these are the lines of maximum stress in the surface of the crystal. There's even a reconstruction here. It looks like a sine wave. That's a little bit of an optical illusion. The atoms are moved out of their equilibrium positions to reduce the stress. Most of, and this is an impurity, probably molecule, maybe it's a H2. So most of these phenomena are not relevant for what I'm going to be talking about today, but they could prove to be very relevant in the long term for understanding high TC, especially this mottling phenomenon. Clearly, these materials are not homogeneous. They never were, they never will be. Now, I've mentioned the issue of the cleanliness of the surface. That's vital for STM. A single molecule of unknown properties between the tip and the sample can give you a completely different result. Okay? We know that no such atoms or molecules are there, because if we have a dirty surface, we see each individual impurity atom on the surface. And after a successful cleave in cryogenic ultra-high vacuum, no new impurity atoms arrive on the surface for periods of months. So once we manage to get it clean, it stays clean. And we can tell when it is clean. So I would like to say that most of the results I report today would be from a surface in this typical condition. We see every single bismuth atom. We know where they are. We know where the copper atoms are underneath. And in addition, some of the techniques, I didn't focus a great deal on the design of the STM instrument, but well, let me just say that the STM head design has the facility that if we choose one of these atoms, we don't lose its identity. We can go through, we can use the machine for all different functions, we can change the magnetic field, we can do whatever we want. We can find that atom again and go back and study it later. And that has proven to be very important. Now, on this surface, it's not the copper-oxygen plane of the D-wave superconductor. It's 5 angstroms away. So what should we expect for the spectrum? Well, let me just remind you of what one should expect in principle for a D-wave spectrum. There's the doped copper-oxygen plane. There's some spin, some carriers and some places where there are no carriers. Here's the Brillouin zone. Here's what the Fermi surface from ARPES. In the D-wave BCS view of the situation, the order parameter registered to these two guys looks like this. There are 4 nodes, and there are 4 maxima, and the sign changes as you go around. And because, you know, the gap is falling continuously from its maximum value down to zero, there are always quasiparticle states at every energy on the average. If you average over all K values, there's always some states. So the density of states and the tunneling spectrum schematically should look like this. That's the gap maximum. That's the gap maximum. There's the Fermi level. It should look like this. So when we go to do that experiment on the surface I just showed you, it looks like this. So clearly, we see a very clear gap in the middle. It's the correct width, usually 45 millivolts is the typical value in our samples. There are some features outside. Clearly, this is not a S-wave gap. It goes down continuously. You could say it's linear down here, but it typically doesn't go to zero. I'll be discussing that during the talk. So this is the main observable, and we can measure this at every single atom in the field of view. Nobody knows. We know that it's repeatable in all STM experiments that have atomic resolution, but we don't necessarily know that that means it's a materials property of the material, because there's some special conditions in an STM experiment, like there's a high electric field in there. Okay, so I think the answer is it's too soon to say what this phenomenon is. Now, imagine that we were going to measure the density of states throughout the sample at this energy here. We're going to measure this number, and we're going to map it throughout the sample. What might you expect to see? Well, based on, you know, intuition from S-wave, effectively you would expect to see nothing. Here's the surface rendered in 3 dimensions. Here's the number we want to measure, the density of states at the Fermi level. Let's map it everywhere in the surface. I'll use a color scale where high quasiparticle density is white or red, and black is low quasiparticle density, and I call this number the Fermi level quasiparticle density. You would just expect it to be black. As soon as this machine came online, the very first experiments showed that that's false. In the high TC superconductors, the density of states at the Fermi level, okay, so here's the same color scale, 30% of the normal density of states, and zero is black. Large areas are black. They have very few quasiparticles at the Fermi level. But as you can all see, there are other areas. I apologize for my focus on focus, but if you spend your life making images, it's... So, you can see all these objects. They're little 3-nanometer pools of quasiparticles. They're about 25 to 30% of the normal density of states. They get together in places, but in other places, they're fairly remote and well-defined. And the first question was, what could those phenomena be? So, and by the way, immediately subsequent to that observation, there was an observation from Don Eigler and his colleagues that if they deposit material from the tip onto a Biscoe surface, they also generated a large peak in the low energy density of states. So these two things came out last year. So, you know, what could be going on, especially in this case where there's no material on the surface, but there's a lot of extra quasiparticles near the Fermi level? Well, the first guess, of course, is that it's the influence of the impurity atoms. And in fact, the first theoretical proposal for what could happen at those sites was made here in Doug Scalapino's group 7 years ago and more now. And they proposed that individual impurity atoms, if you measure the density of states at relatively high energies, then due to the symmetry of the order parameter, at an impurity atom, you should find this fourfold and then alternative fourfold beams of quasiparticles, or somehow perturbation in the gap magnitude at the impurity site. And it was this paper that focused attention on the fact that individual impurity atoms should have a characteristic fourfold symmetry register in the perturbation that they deliver in real space. Now, it happens that this experiment is incredibly difficult to do. We have not been able to do it. We can put the impurity atoms there, but we can't measure the density of states out here and find the fourfold symmetry. And the reason is that the density of states at high energies in this material, optimal Biscoe, is a very rapidly changing function of position. So this is a line. Along this line, we take all these spectra. And if we do it a month later, we'll get exactly the same spectrum. It's not an instrumental problem. It's that the density of states at low energies in this material varies very rapidly. So, for example, if you just parameterize the situation by measuring, you know, the distance between these two peaks and call it 2 delta, and then make a map of delta throughout a given sample, here's a typical result. So here's the delta scale from 25 to 65 millivolts. Blue is down here near 45 millivolts. Most of the sample looks like that. But there's a lot of these regions which have high and some regions which have low. And so mapping the density of states at the gap edge in this material, it's not futile, but it's not going to reveal individual impurity atoms. It's revealing some other very interesting phenomena. So the next proposal about impurity atoms was started by Belotsky, Salcola, and Rosengren. And then later here in Doug Scalapino's group, Salcola, Belotsky. And essentially, they tried to solve the problem of the virtual bound state in the D-wave quasiparticle environment. So if you have an on-site impurity potential, whose strength is given by this number, otherwise it's a delta function, if U is positive, it's a repulsive potential for the electrons and vice versa. You can represent this potential by this parameter here. It's 1 over the density of states at the Fermi level, U times pi. The Green's function is known. The momentum Green's average Green's function is known. And in fact, you can search, and the T-matrix is known. So you can search for the poles in the T-matrix. And if you look at this T-matrix here, the poles occur when this parameter C equals to the Green's function. And so if you solve this implicit equation, you can find the energies at which the virtual bound states for those quasiparticles occur at the impurity atoms. And the solution is shown here. So basically, I go through all the steps. So this is from the original Belotsky, Salcola, Rosengren paper. They find the energy of the virtual bound state. It goes as minus 1 over the potential in a logarithmic correction. And they find the inverse lifetime of the virtual bound state. Now, in a cartoon sense, here's a summary of what that means. Oh, and then I should say, subsequently, the work here at Santa Barbara was to predict what would happen in real space for STM experiments for these states. So in a cartoon sense, when the potential energy of the impurity is repulsive, you get a peak in the density of states on the on the hole-like side, and when the potential is attractive, you get a peak in the density of states on the particle-like side. So the spectrum breaks particle-hole symmetry in D-wave. The impurity state in real space is fourfold symmetric and oriented with the nodes of the gap, and the density of states falls as 1 over r squared, and there's the energy I just showed you. So this is the phenomenon we believe to be associated with these impurity states, and therefore we made a measurement of the density of states exactly at those sites. So here's elsewhere, and here's at one of those scattering sites. There is a little peak in the density of states at negative bias, and this dashed line here is a comparison with the prediction in the papers describing this phenomenon. So there's reasonable agreement between our observations and the prediction. And in addition, the amplitude does fall off as 1 over r squared. We made this measurement by measuring the density of states as a function of radius. So we immediately made the proposal that these are quasiparticle virtual bound states in a D-wave superconductor based on these observations. There are these low energy states. They break particle hole symmetry. The density of states falls off as 1 over r squared, and they're consistent with these so-called impurity states. But of course, this proposal generates as many questions as it generates far more questions than it answers. So the first question is, you know, can one of these resonances or virtual bound states be caused by a single impurity atom? Is that really possible? Secondly, if so, then what would be the effect of the identity of the impurity atom and the crystal location where you put the impurity? And then third, where was the fourfold symmetry predicted by the Scalapino group for the impurity state? And then fourth, you know, are we just fooling ourselves? Do we really get information on high TC from the CuO2 plane through the intervening two planes and up through the vacuum tunneling barrier? And basically, to address all these issues, we tried to do a series of experiments where we had either zinc substituted for copper or nickel substituted for copper in otherwise the most perfect available crystals. So here's an image of the topography of a zinc-doped BISCO surface imaged in our machine. Here's the X and Y axis. You see the mottling. You see the supermodulation. If we go and look at the atoms, there's no distinguishable difference between this surface and the surface of a crystal which is not doped with the zinc or nickel impurity atoms. Basically, the impurity atoms are not here on the surface. Now, remember what we did previously. We measured the density of states near the Fermi level as a function of position here to search for the impurity resonances, to search for the virtual bound states. Well, as soon as we did that on the zinc-doped crystal, which the zinc is about 0.5% of the copper atoms are substituted for zinc, we got this result. So at minus 1.5 millivolts, which we found it at zero, but soon we came to minus 1.5, you'll see why. Most of the material has a very, very low density of states. That's the dark area. But distributed throughout, there are these little crosses. And we now believe that those little crosses are the fourfold symmetric D-wave states at the zinc atoms at the copper site. They have the correct aerial density, and I'll show you they have many other correct phenomena associated with that idea. And, so the appropriate thing to do now is to go to one of these sites and take a high-resolution spectrum to see what's happening to the superconductivity exactly at the impurity site. And this is what the spectrum looks like. So the on-site density of state spectrum, this should be minus 1.5 millivolts, I'm sorry. So here's far away from the impurity atom. That's the typical spectrum. And then here is right on top of the zinc site. The coherence peaks of the superconductivity are killed. And here at minus 1.5 millivolts, a huge, very sharp peak is created. This is more or less the limit of the idea of a virtual bound state. U is going to infinity. So omega, the energy, is going towards zero. You're being pushed up against the Fermi level by the strength of the scattering. So that's kind of the picture we have right now for what happens at the zinc site. And if we go in now, we know where this impurity state is located in space, and we take a simultaneous image of where the bismuth atoms are with high resolution and the shape of the density of states at the appropriate energy, simultaneous map, then we can get a feeling of the register of this impurity state. This is a logarithmic intensity scale, so the dominant direction is here. And if we look at the crystal, these are the copper oxygen bond directions, so the gap maximum is here, so the nodes are here. Well, you see the impurity state is registered to the nodes. Now you see a lot of other phenomena in here, and I'm going to comment on those in a few minutes. But first I'd like to just make a summary and say that within what I would call a D-wave BCS model, simplest possible model of this situation, you take D-wave quasiparticles, you scatter them, S-wave scattering off an object, which is a very simple but strong scatterer, unitary scatterer. This, you know, in different components of this problem have been studied over the last 10 years. There's qualitative agreement between our observations and the wide variety of predictions in here. The impurity state is located at the zinc site. Oh, I'm sorry, I forgot to say something. See that red cross there? That's the bismuth atom, which is exactly centered on the impurity state. If we do this experiment for a large number of different impurity states, they're always located on a bismuth atom. The bismuth atom is always above a copper atom. So that's another piece of evidence that you really are dealing with a zinc at the copper site. So here is the qualitative agreement. So the spectrum looks like unitary non-magnetic scattering. The wave function is four-fold symmetric. It's oriented with the gap nodes. And you'll see that it's related to a coherence length of only about 7 angstroms. But not everything is really consistent with that simple picture. Suppose we now take a look at this high-resolution spatial and image of the magnitude of the wave function of this impurity state. We can check to see where the local maxima are relative to where the atoms are. And if I represent that in an image of where the oxygen atoms are in the copper-oxygen plane, so here's the impurity atom, here's the four nearest neighbor copper atoms, here's the four second nearest neighbor, here's the four third nearest neighbor. So the maxima in this density of states are located at some, but not all, of the copper atom sites. So it looks like this is a non-trivial situation where the impurity state is really localized, registered to the square copper-oxygen plane below. The trivial case would be, you know, if all the atoms were to respond in some way which is decaying with distance, you might say the image is modulated by tunneling through the intervening layers. But that doesn't seem to be the case, because these four nearest neighbor atoms have a very weak response in the real image of the state. Okay, and another way of seeing that is to just draw the position of the copper atoms on top of the impurity state. That's what these red dots are. So you see, here's the scatterer. Here's the four nearest neighbor atoms. They have a very weak response. They actually have a little minimum. And then the four second nearest neighbor atoms have a strong response, and so on. So the real space structure of this object is a good deal more complicated than you would have guessed from a homogeneous D-wave BCS model of the situation. And the physics of this is not really well understood at the moment. So back to real observables, we can measure the density of states as it falls off in the different directions. So it's gone down by two orders of magnitude within 15 angstroms. So that's why I say the coherence length here is a very small number. And we can measure the recovery of the superconductivity from its highly suppressed condition back to normal over a distance maybe of 15 angstroms before it gets back to normal at the zinc site. Okay, so I want to move on from here. So let me just summarize the status of the zinc atoms. There's a number of new atomic scale phenomena that are not really understood having to do with this state. The shape, the register, the fact that only some copper sites are registered to the wave function. There are these weak quasiparticle beams going off towards the gap maxima. And basically, it's a very complicated dependence of the density of states on distance. Probably to solve this problem, one needs to use wave functions which are local. Okay, so now I'd like to turn to the issue of a magnetic impurity atom. Now we have an idea of what happens if you put a strong scattering, potential scatterer, in a D-wave superconductor. If you put a magnetic impurity atom, well, the first guess would be, I'm sorry, not guess, the first predictions would be that suppose there's no potential scattering. You get a solution which is very, very much like the Shiba one. There's a magnetic moment embedded in the D-wave superconductor. Scattering generates particle hole symmetric spin polarized states at energy omega. The solution for omega is known, And the only thing is that the real space structure of these states has the D-wave symmetry and is oriented with the gap nodes. So this is kind of this is a very sophisticated view of the situation, but it turns out to be too simple for what happens at a real magnetic atom embedded in D-wave. A slightly more sophisticated version of this problem is when you consider what happens if you have, here's the impurity potential, you have potential scattering, and you also have this classical spin, so there's some exchange energy associated with the hopping of the conduction electrons onto and off of this site. So now you can represent this combined potential in the previous form, and you can solve again using the same T-matrix technique. And now a simple solution, there are several complicated solutions, but one of the simple solutions is that if U is a good deal bigger than W, the magnetic energy, then you will find two states. So U is bigger than W, so this piece doesn't change sign. The two states have one sign, but they're split from each other by the magnetic energy, W. And the reason why I'm telling you about this is that some form of this is what's actually observed. So here's a picture of the 0.5% nickel-doped PISCO. And now, for a moment, I'd like to make a comment about the materials people. Aisaki and Uchida in Tokyo, Aisaki's in Stanford now. It's extraordinarily difficult to make these materials. They're ultra pure, the highest purity high TC crystals, which are then have a 0.5% of some pre-chosen impurity atoms substituted at a pre-chosen site. Without that ability, the STM experiments would not have been able to definitively reveal any information. But we can be very confident, we now know from multiple tries, that in fact there are only nickel atoms here, except for one part in 10,000 of a few other things. So here's what the nickel surface looks like. So you remember what we did is measure the density of states near the Fermi level and look for the scattering resonances. And the aerial density of what we should see here is known. And at the Fermi level, for nickel atoms, we don't see a strong response. There should be approximately 50 nickel atom resonances in this field of view at zero energy. This is the same surface I just showed you. And there's only approximately 3. These two guys, whose physics is unknown at the moment, although I could comment on it later. This one, I believe, by looking at it, is a zinc impurity atom that got in there by mistake. So where are the nickel resonances? They're not near the Fermi level. So what we do is we sequentially go out to higher and higher and higher and higher sample bias, searching for the resonances. And the first response is seen near 10 millivolts. And we were very, very surprised by this. I'm still surprised by this. Here's the nickel resonances. At positive bias now, at 10 millivolts, there's a bright dot for each nickel atom. The aerial density of these guys is correct. We had another batch of crystals made with one-third the aerial density. We found one-third of these same phenomena. We're sure they're the nickel atoms. So each of them has a cross. The cross is oriented with the gap nodes. You can see that yourself from this image. The nodes are this way and that way. So each of these guys at positive bias has a cross oriented with the gap nodes. And now, if you go to the symmetric, so these are the electron-like states in the superconductor. For each one of these, at the opposite energy for the hole-like states, there's another localized state. And it's not, it's rotated by 45 degrees exactly from the one over here. I think this is amazing. The real space quasi-electron states are different than the real space hole states, and probably they're differently spin-polarized as well, although we have no explicit way of proving that yet. So we go to each one of these sites and take the spectrum to see what's happening. And here's what the spectrum looks like. So here's the spectrum far away, the background spectrum of the D-wave superconductor. And here's the spectrum exactly at the nickel site. And now what you see is the coherence, superconducting coherence, has survived at the impurity atom in this material, but only for the hole-like states. The particle-like states have been eaten away, and they've been replaced by two resonances, which are here at two positive energies. And our present picture of the situation is that this distance here to the center is dominated by the potential scattering, And this splitting between them is the energy between the spin-up and spin-down states at that magnetic moment. You might say that this idea of a classical magnetic moment embedded in there is really a very simple idea. Really, you should consider the quantum states available to the moment. But it's believed that nickel is S equals 1, so at least it's not as bad as S equals a half. That's what I could say about it. So now what we'd like to do is go and image the real space structure of the wave function for this state or that state. And in fact, as you saw, there's at least two other states available as well. So the real space structure looks like this. So this is a simultaneous high-resolution image showing where the bismuth atoms are. At the central bismuth atom, underneath this bismuth atom, is where the nickel atom is. Registered to the nickel site is this bright cross with this dim box around it. See these dark areas here? Well, they're bright over here at the other energy. These are the quasi-electron states, and these are the quasi-hole states. It's not known. Yeah, it certainly wasn't predicted. So, I mean, I could make some hand-waving arguments for why it... The hand-waving arguments is that these are the quasi-particles and these are the quasi-holes. In the presence of the spin scattering, if you generate a strong quasi-particle state with a certain orientation, then in order to preserve u squared plus v squared equals 1 in the whole region, you must have a strong quasi-hole state elsewhere. But that argument was never considered in the original discussions. Right? If u squared is 1 along here, well then v squared must be 0. But if the superconductivity has survived, v squared must be 1 someplace else. So that's a kind of a hand-waving argument. Okay, so let me just say what the qualitative situation is here. There's qualitative agreement between these original predictions of Salkola, Bilatsky, and Schrieffer, and also some predictions of Flatey and Byers. There is an impurity state at the nickel site. The density of state spectrum is consistent with weak potential scattering and also weak magnetic scattering. The impurity state is fourfold symmetric. It's oriented with the gap nodes on site. And the coherence gap magnitude, if you just take the surviving side, the gap magnitude is not suppressed in this whole region. And I find that to be an amazing fact. It somehow exchanges coherence peaks for impurity states on alternate sites. So if we go with register to the positions of the copper atoms, we see something like this, as I was trying to point out. So here's the gap node direction. Here's the on-site resonance at the nickel site. It's registered to the nickel atom and the four second nearest neighbor atoms and the four third nearest neighbor atoms. On the other hand, if you go to the this is the quasi-electron side. This is the quasi-hole side. It's registered to the first nearest neighbor atoms, and then it decays quickly. One thing I'll point out here is that in the CuO2 square lattice, if you choose this as the center, then these two and these two are the two alternate antiferromagnetic sublattices of the system. Okay. So now there's one other way of representing this situation, which actually turns out perhaps to be more revealing as to how the physics is working. And it's to take the spectrum at each canonical atom in that field of view. So here's my square lattice. Here's X and Y. Here's B and A. Here's my nickel atom. Here's the four nearest neighbors, four second nearest neighbors, and here's infinity. So at infinity, you get this black D wave spectrum. At the nickel atom, you get a spectrum whose coherence survives on the hole side. There's a little blip here. There's two big peaks on the particle side. The coherence is gone. At the four nearest neighbor atoms, look at these two peaks. They're gone. Okay? That's the blue curve represents the four nearest neighbor atoms. So this peak is gone. This peak is gone. But look over here. They have been generated on the other side at the same energies. Then at the four second nearest neighbor atoms, that's the green curve, these two peaks are gone. But they have appeared over on this side. As the impurity peaks alternate between hole and particle side, the coherence peaks alternate between hole and particle side. It's a complicated dance whereby the superconductivity can survive in the presence of this scatterer. And it's been well known for 10 years that nickel does not suppress superconductivity in high TC crystals anywhere near as much as it should. Well, now we see that the high TC can do a very delicate dance to avoid that damage. Okay, so there's one other thing I'd like to show you, which is the overall spectrum. Yeah, I'll be finished in a couple of minutes. So we can represent this situation by showing the spectrum at each atom. So here's the nickel atom. There's the coherence peak. Here's the impurity peaks. If we go to the four nearest neighbor atoms, the coherence peak is here. Okay, and the impurity peaks have appeared on the other side. If we go to the four second nearest neighbor atoms, the coherence peak is here, and the impurity peaks have flopped back to the first side. And that process goes on out to the sixth nearest neighbor atom in a very complicated dance. So, okay. Here's a summary of what we now know about the nickel scatterer. There's an electron-like and hole-like resonance. They're probably spin polarized. We have some evidence that they are, but the signal-to-noise for atomic resolution spin polarization measurements, even today, is not very high. The wave function is somehow composed of particle-hole symmetric but spatially distinct structures. And the electron-like and hole-like components are registered to different antiferromagnetic sublattices. And, overall, it's a very complicated situation that really had not been predicted in any detail. Now I'd like to give you a summary of the simple D-wave BCS view of the situation without implying that the full explanation of these phenomena can be achieved through that channel. So here's what it appears like is happening. The zinc atom is repulsive for the conduction electrons. So according to theory, that should generate a peak in the density of states at negative sample bias or on the hole-like side. This is theory. This is what we see. There is a very sharp peak at low energy on the hole-like side. According to theory, this peak should be fourfold symmetric about these axes. We see something more, a little bit more complicated. If there was weak magnetic scattering, we wouldn't discern it because U is so big that the perturbation from W would be embedded in this peak. We don't know if there's any weak magnetic scattering there. Now imagine if nickel were not magnetic, just the potential component of its scattering. You could guess that it might be like this. It's on the other side of copper in the periodic table. Let's suppose that it's an attractive potential. So it would generate a peak in the density of states on the electron-like side. We don't know what that looks like. But one could guess that this peak might have the same fourfold symmetry of the D-wave quasiparticle virtual bound state. Now, in reality, it appears within this D-wave BCS view of the situation that the nickel atom is attractive, and it does have spin 1. So there is some magnetic energy associated with having quasiparticles on this site. So from theory, that would predict a situation like this. A resonance on this side, which is split by the magnetic energy. This line here is what we observe, a resonance on this side split by the magnetic energy. And the prediction is that both of these peaks would have the same real space structure, and they do. So that's our summary of the phenomena at the impurity atoms. We have one other set of data for what we think are vacancy resonances, but I don't have time to discuss that today. I want to comment on one other issue, which is the legitimacy of the conclusions from these observations. You're tunneling from the copper site through either a strontium or an oxygen atom, then through either an oxygen or a bismuth atom, then through vacuum into a tip, which is usually made of platinum. So how could it be that you could be lucky enough to see all those phenomena? Your glasses are highly distorted. Your tunneling glasses are very distorted by that process. Well, I don't know the answer to that question. What I can say is, from the empirical point of view, there are multiple phenomena that can only be associated with D-wave superconductivity, which are observable at the bismuth layer. We can observe the D-wave spectrum, and we can measure its spatial structure. We can observe the vortex core states when the magnetic field is on. This is the spectrum of a vortex core. There are core states inside. We can image the vortices and simultaneously image the surface. I can't imagine how you could image the vortex core states unless you're accessing the D-wave order parameter. We can image the potential scattering, and we can image the magnetic scattering. So somehow, you can access that surface. It must be that the intervening layers are relatively inert. They probably perturb the response without destroying it. Here's the future issues in this area. There are some other techniques that have effective atomic scale resolution. There's neutron scattering, there's NMR, there's a lot of NMR data about impurity atoms, and there's some ARPA-IS data. One should be able to combine all these observations with the new real space observations and come to one conclusion about what phenomena can be occurring at these sites. But so the data is too new. So far we don't know whether this is really possible. And in fact, the NMR data is coming fast and furious now. There have been two more FISRAV letters since I wrote this view graph. So we're just playing catch up to see whether we can understand what happens at the impurity atoms. And then the final thing I'd like to say is that this work would have been completely impossible without the people in my group who worked for many years on the development of the instrument. This is Professor Xuheng Pan. He's on the faculty of Boston University now. He's world-renowned for designing STMs. When he came to my group, I asked him to design an STM to attack this problem. He just did it. He's fantastic. This is Eric Hudson. He was a graduate student and a postdoc, and he also built this machine. And he's the one, he did all the nickel experiments himself, and he did most of the zinc experiments. He's really a fantastic guy. And then these two guys have left. He's at NIST now. And this is the new team that's working on the nickel experiments, Christine Lang and Vidya Madhavan. Vidya is quite well known. She did the nickel condo experiment in gold in Micromax Group in Boston. So the credit goes to these people. Thanks very much. We certainly don't see any scattering resonances which could be associated with oxygen atom vacancies because, you know, independent, when we put impurities there, we see the response. If there were some other class of impurities there, we would see it anyway, and we don't. And we don't see the oxygens in the surface because they're not hybridized. They don't contribute a lot to the density of states at the Fermi level. So we have very little knowledge of what happens to the oxygen atoms. Could I say no to that question? I think I would like to make one comment, which is that this image, I can't find it right now. Here's a compact version of it. The rapid spatial variation of the size of the gap magnitude as a function of position is ubiquitous in BISCO. We've seen it at every single crystal we've ever looked at. Depending on your point of view, either there are stripes in here or there are not. I couldn't comment on that. The inhomogeneity is without doubt. Yeah, YBCO, when you cleave YBCO, you relieve the copper-oxygen chain plane. The copper-oxygen chain plane is very heavily striped, but it's not superconducting stripes. It's a one-dimensional electron gas with strong correlations in it. And that was discovered by Alex de la Zan almost 10 years ago. Yeah. So the vortex cores are not four-fold symmetric. They're azimuthally symmetric. And these states inside decay exponentially with radius. So it looks to us like they're bound quasiparticle states in a fully gapped region. There are multiple ways that in the presence of the magnetic field, an additional component of the order parameter can be induced, either by virtue of the self-consistency requirements for the structure of the vortex core or for the whole sample itself, depending on who you talk to. So, you know, D plus IS or D plus I DXY could explain this observation. Yes, sir.
But
Yes, that's an excellent question. So it's so here's the spectrum which I use to represent the canonical properties of this material. So you can check out how strong, let's say how passive the tunneling matrix element between the tip and the sample is by starting at infinity. You take the spectrum and then you go in, you take another spectrum, you go in, you take another spectrum, and so on. From an empirical point of view, you can show a distance range over which this spectrum is independent of at least the magnitude of the tunneling matrix element. Okay, and then eventually when the junction resistance gets in below 100 megohms, then the spectrum starts to get distorted. And at that scale, you really are perturbing the matrix element from being just a simple number to being something which probably has to do with geometry and electric fields and so on. So from the empirical point of view, what we try to do is to take these spectra at a high enough junction resistance that we hope that we're not perturbing the electronic density of states. We don't see any candidates which are sufficiently close but still recognizable at the density we have. It's a very good suggestion to do these experiments at a higher density. But sometimes Mother Nature is not so forgiving. As you know, the solubility of one material in another is not infinite, so you can't actually choose an arbitrary density. Like those nickel resonances?
Yes, I do.
They're amazing.
They are amazing.
Oh, hi. Nice to meet you at last, after reading your papers hundreds of times.
I'm so glad you could come over. Oh, that's amazing. I guess this
I don't know how I forgot, yesterday, or not yesterday, the time I saw you, you mentioned that this was going on.
So there is one other phenomenon there. It looks like when there's a vacancy, there's a different type of resonance.
Oh, really?
Yeah, when the copper atom is missing, there's a third category of resonance. So you identified a very rich vein of physics. Yeah, I know. That's a very complicated business. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What about
Tesla? For political reasons, I'm not able to get LSCO.
Uh-huh. What about MCCO?
I haven't tried.
You know, currently Shui has reported that it looks D-wave in terms of the half flux, in terms of trapped.
To be honest, one of the things we're focusing on is strontium ruthenate, because it might be more interesting to see the P-wave impurity state. than to see another D-wave state.
Yeah,
but, you know, these materials are quite rare and the lead time to make them is up to a year. If the makers have agreed to give the sample to somebody else, then you can't come at a later stage and say, well, why don't you give me some of your sample? So it's a complicated dance.
Of course, the impurity potentials that are pure and theory and that you analyze.
Yeah. Yes.
If the impurity potential I don't know. You might not be surprised. You commented it wasn't exactly, you know, the fourfold structure.
I'm not surprised by that at all. I'm surprised that it's possible to know that that in fact is the case. Since there were only a very small number of calculations in advance of the experiment, that's the status that we're at now. Right now, there's a large, well, there's a large number of calculations going on now for atomic scale.